Did anyone wake up this morning and say to themselves, my bed is too comfortable? Did anyone turn on their shower and be like, oh, Julie Prince did, wow, you are a lucky person. Did anyone wake up this morning and say, my shower, my hot water is too hot, I can't stand it? Or did anyone wake up struggling with the surplus amount of money they have in their bank account this morning? Yeah, most people laugh. The reality is 99% of us, 99% of the time, aren't even going to ask ourselves those questions because it's usually the opposite. Oh, my bed is uncomfortable, my neck is sore, my back hurts. Or we turn on the shower and why isn't this water warm enough? I'm freezing, especially this winter, right? That was our experience, I'm sure. Or we look at our bank account and we ask ourselves, am I going to have enough for this or am I going to have enough for that? And we worry about it. There was a period in church history when there was a group of men and some women who fled civilization and all the comforts that it offered in the 3rd and 4th and 5th century AD. So I don't know what kind of comforts those were. I mean, a straw mattress maybe and a bath once a week. But they fled those comforts that they had for the desert. Now, the one who started it, and the movement ended up being called, the people who did it were called Desert Fathers. And the movement started around 300 AD, right at the time when Constantine the First legalized Christianity in the Roman Empire. So the man who started it, his name was Anthony the Great. And I got a picture of him. It's not high resolution. And they managed to get a picture with the sun directly behind his head. So that was quite a feat, I think, back then. But he was a man who was after God. And when Christianity became legal, sacrificing yourself for God, martyrdom was no longer there. Before Constantine the First, there was a lot of martyrdom happening within the Roman Empire. And it was a great honor to sacrifice oneself for Christ. But that was no longer an option. So Anthony thought, well, what else can I do? So he thought, I will flee to the desert, denying myself, denying the comforts that civilization offers and living in the desert. And Anthony started a movement. There were many others that followed him. And for lack of a better word, I'm going to call them desert monks. I mean, they wouldn't have called themselves monks at that time. The word hadn't been invented, but that's essentially what they were. And so they denied those pleasures and chose a hard, challenging life. So what they would do, they would spend hours in prayer. They would spend hours in solitude. They would sometimes, you know, form in little like monasteries, for lack of a better word, even knowing that technically wasn't what it was. And they would, you know, do a lot of fasting. They also did learn trades and stuff. So they would weave baskets, is one example, or other simple trades to sell merchandise to earn money. And the reason they earned money was to help sustain themselves if they would buy food, if they were in a spot they couldn't buy or grow food for themselves. But the monks themselves, they would struggle with the amount of money they would earn. And so they would just give most of it away, blessing the poor in neighboring villages and cities and in the regions they were in. Now here's what I find interesting about these desert monks and about the movement in general. I often wonder, why would God call them to the desert and not interact with people? I mean, where did they see that in the scriptures? So I'm challenged by that concept, and I don't have a good answer for it. Perhaps God really did call them to the desert. Regardless of whether he did or not, God still worked through that community to bless others. They would be sought out by neighboring villages or towns. People would go seek them out for advice, for guidance, what they're to do. They gave as much money as they could to the poor. Like, they blessed people. And they left behind a legacy of, like, many wise sayings and thoughtful sayings about God and holy living. And they were
They were just very selfless. They denied themselves, and in doing so, they left a legacy behind that still is remembered 1,800 years later. Now, this week, we're going to turn back to Galatians. We're going to be looking at chapter 5, but let's remember that the entire tension of the letter of Galatians, and we've been going through it all year, so those of you who have been with us kind of already know what it is, and that the followers of Jesus Christ in the city of Galatia were trying to create this gospel where people needed to follow the law to receive Christ's grace and freedom. And so the last time Jeremy preached before our Easter season, he taught about how the Galatians were teaching that circumcision was necessary for the men. Now, why would that be? I mean, part of it is that many of them would have been Jews who were now Christians. The scriptures they had was just the Old Testament. So what they knew about God, what they knew about living a holy life, was found entirely in the Old Testament. The only problem with the Old Testament is the law is unfulfilled. Jesus hadn't come yet, so they still see it. They still would read it as if they needed to follow all the law. And then they would also receive the freedom of Christ. So, you know, obviously we've gone through it. That's obviously incorrect in what they were thinking. And so Paul now begins to transition the letter of Galatians in chapter 5 from law and freedom in Christ to spirit and flesh. Here's the passage we're looking at today. Live by the Spirit, I say, and do not gratify the desires of the flesh. For what the flesh desires is opposed to the Spirit, and what the Spirit desires is opposed to the flesh. For these are opposed to each other to prevent you from doing what you want. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not subject to the law. That's from the New Revised Standard Version. This is one of those passages where you read it, three simple verses, and it seems fairly simple on the one hand. But it's very challenging when I was reading it, when I was studying it, to really know how to practically apply it to our lives. I mean, simply put, if we just read it, Paul says, well, live by the Spirit and deny and do not gratify the desires of the flesh. Done. That's our sermon for today. Please do that. No, see, it's hard to apply. What does that mean, live by the Spirit? What does it mean to oppose the flesh? Jeremy has spoken a little bit about the flesh over the course of this year. He's touched on it a bit. But here Paul makes such a stark contrast between spirit and flesh that I feel we need to first understand the two words and go into a definition of them. So the first word I want to look at is flesh. The Greek word for flesh is sarx. Now, in the ancient Greek, so we're talking 3,000 to 2,000 BC, so a long, long time ago, it referred to all the soft parts of the body. So your skin, your muscle tissue, didn't refer to bones or anything like that. Slowly, over time, the word and the meaning changed. In Koine Greek, which is the Greek that the New Testament was written in, it was the common tongue of the Roman Empire when Jesus was born. And in Koine Greek, it referred to the entirety of the body, the whole body, every piece. Now, what Paul does, I feel like Paul pulls a little bit of a William Shakespeare, and he changes the meaning of the word a little bit more. And it means more than just our bodies. So what do I mean by that? So in Paul's usage of the word sarx, he first and foremost, he does refer to it as our whole body, and there are different texts where you can see Paul's using the word in that reference. But it's more than that. He also refers to it as our sinful nature. And in the sinful nature is that part of us that's entirely self-centered and consumed with achieving our own goals, the part of us that sins, plain and simple. And you know what? That part that's just consumed with ourselves, it starts at a very young age. The other night, my wife Nicole and I, we went out for ice cream at Marble Slab. And it was, you know, we took Elijah, our son, with us. He's almost 2 years old. And Nicole had walked into Marble Slab to get the ice cream, and I was sitting in the car with Elijah and just trying to keep him distracted because it was getting close to bedtime. And we were just thinking, well, we'll be able to take the ice cream home. He won't notice, and we can just throw him in bed. Well, wouldn't you know it, as Nicole's walking back to the car, she's holding the two cups of ice cream in her hands, and Elijah looks out the window, and what's the first thing he says? He goes, me, 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 me. It's about him. You know, it's very cute, and it was funny. But it starts at such a young age, because we're born with this sinful nature, this self-centered nature, this self-serving nature. That's all about us and serving our needs. And so he just shouts it. And we gave him a little bit. We weren't so mean. So that's kind of the first part. The New Living Translation, another translation of the Bible, actually translate the word sarx to mean this, because that's the prominent meaning Paul's getting at. But the word itself does have a bit more meaning to it. You can see the third one I have up there is human nature. And what do I mean by that? Well, when we were made, God made us in the flesh, but it says in Genesis that he made us in his likeness. Well, what does that mean? Well, we know when Jesus was born, theologians wrestle with this question still today, but Jesus was born in the flesh, a full body, full man, but he was also born with the human nature. Like, he was fully God and fully man. It's one of those mysteries of our faith that people have wrestled with for a long time, and, you know, we don't often think about it. But he was fully God and fully man. He wasn't half and half, a dose of both. He was both at the same time. It's one of those mysteries that's hard to understand, but it is what the Scripture teaches. So he had a human nature in him. But when Adam and Eve ate of the fruit, Genesis 3, our human nature was corrupted. And sin corrupted it, again, making us also have a very sinful nature. So in Romans 8:3, Paul writes about this topic of flesh a number of times. And in Romans 7 and 8, he talks about it, writes about it extensively. But in Romans 8, verse 3, Paul writes, and this is from the New American Standard Version. Just, I like the way they translate it a little better for this, for understanding this part. For what the law could not do, weak as it was through the flesh, God did, sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh and as an offering for sin. He condemned sin in the flesh. See, Paul says that our flesh tried to follow the law. And this is where the meaning of flesh has a few meanings, or this is where I can glean from what Paul's writing that there's a few meanings to the word flesh. See, our sinful nature wouldn't try to follow the law at all. It's completely opposed and in rebellion to God. But there's part of it that God, when God gave the Israelites the law, it was through their flesh that they tried to follow it. But corrupted as we are through sin, we still always felt short. So our human nature tried to obey the law. So then the passage goes on to say, he then says Jesus looked like sinful flesh. See, Jesus was fully man, but he also had a full nature of humanity in him too. And so when Jesus was sacrificed on the cross, his sin was able to be, or our sin was able to be fully taken out, fully sacrificed, and it was fully condemned through Jesus. And that's where I see Jesus had a perfect human nature. We do not. Now, the second word in this passage is the Spirit. The Greek word for spirit in the New Testament is pneuma. So again, this word itself also went through some change over time. The word originally meant wind, breath, or air. You can kind of see the word pneumonia that we have today. This is part of the origins of the word. And in the ancient Greek, it used to mean, you know, air, wind, breath, life. Later, we're talking 500 years before Jesus was born, I think it was about 500, the philosopher Plato changed the meaning of pneuma again to mean the incorporeal part of man. So what did Plato mean by that? See, Plato believed that the world was divided into two realms, one of ideas and one of form. So the world of ideas, or the realm of ideas, was the world that we see around us. Chairs, lights, plants, grass, trees, etc., you and I. But then there was the world. Yeah, so that was the idea, that's the realm of ideas. And then there's the realm of forms, which is static and true. And this was kind of that understanding of where he got the word pneuma, spirit, where it's, I believe he almost believed that we had this eternal part of us that when we died, our flesh would die, but then, you know, there would be some sort of eternal part to us. And so scholars have sometimes accused Paul of kind of writing this way, that our flesh was bad and sinful and that, you know, our spirit was the incorporeal part of us and we would live forever just as a spirit being. And even today, you see this sometimes in Christian funerals or sometimes in our hymns and songs. There's a very old hymn and very famous bluegrass hymn called "I'll Fly Away." It's featured on a Jars of Clay album. It's about 10, 11, 12 years old. Love the song. It's a cool song, great musically. But the theology is incorrect in the song. Here's a couple verses from it. "Some bright morning when this life is over, I'll fly away. To a land on God's celestial shore, I'll fly away. When the shadows of this life have grown, I'll fly away. Like a bird from these prison walls, I'll fly away." Nice wording, right? It's very poetic. It's very beautiful. But you can see it separates spirit and physical flesh. Like a bird from these prison walls, our body is a prison wall? Where's that in the scripture? See, if we read the Bible from start to finish, if we get to the end and read in Revelations, you find that heaven is not a realm of spirits. Heaven is a physical place where there's a new heaven and a new earth. Heaven comes down, a new city of Jerusalem, and we are resurrected. Just like we learned last week, and remembered last week, Jesus was resurrected. He wasn't resurrected as a spirit being. He had to go up to the apostles and say, "See the holes in my hand, the hole in my side." He was a physical being and is a physical being. And so when Paul is using the word pneuma, he's not referring to it in that platonic sense of there's spirit and flesh, and the flesh is entirely bad. Our flesh is sinful. Certainly. But at some point, we don't know when, we will be fully redeemed and we'll be resurrected and be physical beings once again. So you can't dissect them and separate them together. And that's a key understanding to this passage, because sometimes we would just want to read it as there's the spirit that's the good side and the flesh that's entirely the bad side. Well, God made us as physical beings right from the beginning, and that's how he designed us to be. So he's going to redeem us. He's going to fix what was wronged. So that's pretty heady. I love thinking about that stuff. I just love digging deep into theology and that sort of thing. But the passage is about the war within us of spirit and flesh. And how do we apply that to our lives? The question I asked earlier, that's still the challenging part of this whole section. So in verse 17, Paul writes, just go back to that for us here. Paul writes, once again, not verse 17, verse 18, "But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not subject to the law." I want to point out the obvious first. The passage, a few verses from now, Jeremy's going to be preaching on it. It's going to lead us to the fruit of the Spirit, living in the Spirit. The fruit of the Spirit will be some of the qualities that we will have. We're going to have love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, fruitfulness, gentleness, self-control. These nine qualities sum up a life of living in the Spirit. And Jeremy, again, is going to be preaching on them over a number of weeks. We're going to hear some testimonies from people. It's going to be really interesting and good. So what I wanted to look at is, what is the experience of living in the Spirit. You know, I wanted to take a slightly different approach just to try to help us understand it that much more. And here's what I believe God wants us to take away from this passage today. That our self-centeredness dies when we live by the Spirit. Self-centeredness dies when we live by the Spirit. See, our flesh is self-serving. It's self-centered. Our sinful nature wants us to serve us and us alone. Even our human nature that once was designed to follow the law perfectly still ends up just serving ourselves. When we begin to live by the Spirit, our self-centeredness dies. Now, as I was thinking about this, I thought, you know, there's times in my life when I can look back and say, you know, I was living by the Spirit then. But I realized it's really hard to know in the present, as you're going about in your day-to-day walk, if you're living by the Spirit or not. That's really hard to discern. And I'll be honest, I don't have an answer for that one yet. All I can still do is reflect on it and try to learn from my reflections of what I've lived in the past to try to help me live better in the present and future. So I want to just share a story of my life where I feel like I was living by this, where I feel like I lived by the Spirit. My wife, Nicole, and I are expecting our second child. And when we found out we were pregnant last November, we were a little shocked and stunned. It wasn't quite, we've always wanted a second child, but it wasn't quite according to our timing. And I was panicking inside, not because I wasn't ready for a second child in the sense of, you know, I can love a little baby. It's no problem doing that. But I was now going to have to be the sole provider for my family. And financially, I'm speaking of specifically. In the past, in our marriage, we've always relied on both of our incomes to get by. And now it was just going to be mine. And I didn't have the perfect setup of jobs to make that happen. See, I had recently gotten this position, and I was super happy about that and really excited. But the other job I had was working at Home Depot across the street. And surprise, surprise, retail doesn't really pay that much, so we were going to be coming up short. And so for the next couple weeks, I started praying a lot because I didn't really believe I was going to find a job. I was doubtful because I had tried in the past, and I didn't know if there was going to be a job that would pay enough to sustain us both. So I started asking family and friends, this was even before they knew we were pregnant, just to keep their eyes open for us, suggestions on how to find work and that sort of thing. And a couple weeks after Nicole and I found out we were pregnant, we sat down and forced ourselves to take a long look at our finances and what would happen if I didn't get a new job. And we saw with our income as we were breaking down the year of 2015 that we could, in fact, make it. Barely, but we could do it. So when, and another little timbit here, when Nicole and I talk finances, and maybe you have a perfect marriage and this would never occur to you guys, but we often run into disagreements on how to spend our money or where to spend our money or where to put it. So, you know, that's just us being real, you know. And in this conversation, we never had a disagreement. It was really weird, but really awesome because we didn't have a disagreement. We were just like, okay, this is our money. Here's the absolute essentials we need. I guess we can make it. And so after we had had our financial discussion, we sat down and we prayed together. We asked God to provide a job so that I could make enough money to support our family. Again, I was still doubtful. I was still very unsure what would happen. But we also had a dollar amount of saying, God, if we could have this much more, that would be perfect. So I was ready to apply to more jobs, some night shift kind of jobs, and just I wasn't looking forward to the kind of jobs I was going to apply to, but I was like, no, like, You know, something's got to be out there. And so as I was ready to do this, the next day I received a call from my brother saying there was this job opportunity in my hometown. And he's not a Christian, so he doesn't fully grasp the importance of this position at the church here. He understands it's important to me, but, you know, he's like, it's part-time. It's not, you know, it's not that great. You would want something full-time or whatever. And so he was talking to me about this job. He's like, it's full-time. It's just a great opportunity to manage this small store. It's kind of up your alley of what you've been doing in retail all these years. And it's from our hometown, so I would know a lot of people there. So my brother told me to call his one friend who worked there. So I called his friend, talked to him for a little while, and explained to him my situation and said, what I'm actually looking for is part-time work, not full-time. And, you know, here's kind of the days I could foresee being able to work and that sort of thing. And I shared my experience with him. And he just, you know, was very patient on the phone. And he was like, okay, well, you know what? I'm going to pass this on to the owner. And, you know, I'll let you know if he wants to talk to you or not. So a couple hours later, he had already talked to the owner, I guess. And he said, you know, give the owner a call. Let him, you know, talk to you. He wants to talk to you. So I called him. And the owner, I know him through family connections. My mom babysat his kids as they were growing up. My grandmother's farm backed onto his farm. And he had grown up beside my grandmother's farm because his father owned the farm beside my grandmother's. So there was all kinds of these family connections going on. And he said, well, this, you know, he got all the information he needed from me about, you know, my experience and all that stuff. And he said, you know, I'll give you a call tomorrow. I'll talk with the other partners and we'll just talk tomorrow, see if there's anything more we want to know about you. For me, I still wasn't sure. I was like, why would they want somebody who's working 30 hours when they previously just had somebody quit on them who was 40 hours a week and completely committed to that job and all that sort of thing. He called me a couple hours later that same day and he said, what's your email? And I gave it and he said, okay, I'm going to send you over a job offer. Look it over if you want. Call me tonight, accept it, or call me tomorrow. And when I looked at the job offer, it was everything we had asked God. It was the 30 hours a week. It was the pay increase. And even the location itself, my mom has made a career out of babysitting. And now we had a babysitter that I can drop Elijah off, who's literally 2 minutes down the road. It was perfect. I want to say too perfect, but that's because God, you know, designed it. And so why I said earlier today, I believe God is communicating to us today that self-centeredness dies when we live in the Spirit. And while this story I tell you seems to come off as miraculous, and it is in some regard, I think it also exemplifies a role we play in living in the Spirit. So I want to break it down a little more. I want to tell you a little more history of what was leading up to even before Nicole and I found out we were pregnant. So while we were praying for a new job really intensely there, for the past few years, I had been praying for a different job from Home Depot. Yeah, you know, it's a fun store to go shop in, but, you know, when you've worked there for four and a half years, you've seen it all, and it's, you know, it just gets mundane. You don't feel like you have much worth there after a long time, or I didn't. And I was getting to a point where I was like, why would anybody even hire me? I just have Home Depot experience on my resume, you know, a bit of church experience, but anybody in the world, what do they know about that or care about that? And so I was at a point where earlier in the fall, I was just determined to work as many hours as I could. I picked up a third job selling produce at different markets around Southern Ontario and just working a lot of hours and just trying to provide for my family, trying to do it myself. And as I've been reflecting on this story, for my life, the flesh in me, I was trying to earn and trying to provide for my family myself, but the harder I worked, the less things seemed to work out. That's my story and part of it. For some of you out there, the harder you guys work, the more the success you guys seem to have. There's going to be a few of you out there because everybody's got a bit of a different journey. So I can only share my experience of that journey where the harder I've worked, the less things seem to fall into place. Even when I was starting to look for different pastoral positions right out of seminary, I was trying to work hard and trying to send out resumes and that sort of thing, but it was a roadblock after roadblock. And it just never seemed to work out. And so I just said, you know, God, I'm just going to be patient. I sense you still want me at Country Hills, and I don't know why, but I'll just be patient there and just try to work hard there and do my best there. And I believe God created the opportunity I have right now in the position I have. But it took years. And really, as much as our situation with getting a baby and getting a new job was, it seems miraculous in a sense, and it is, because just how quickly God answered that prayer, those prayers we had, I was making those prayers for years for a change from Home Depot, and just nothing happened. And so it took patience, a quality of the Spirit. There you go. So what I wanted to close with that is that my mentality changed. When we looked at our finances, for the longest time, it was me. I needed to provide. I needed to do it. I needed to work harder. And when we looked at our finances and I saw, oh, we could actually make it by if I didn't get a new job. We do have the income. I started to say, God, thank you that we will have the income in that prayer. And if you could, please provide another job. You know, we trust that you will, but you know, you have given us enough. So we'll try not to stress in the meantime. And then he answered the prayer just like that. It was a slight shift. It was subtle. But it's there. From being, I wanted to do it. I can make it happen. To, oh, I guess you have provided enough already, God. But if you could, just so we're not quite as stressed, please, we ask for more. That reliance on God, that living in the Spirit. So now I want to close this sermon with a song that is a prayer. And it's a prayer that was written by St. Patrick of Ireland over 1,500 years ago. Most of us think of St. Patrick's Day. We think of clovers and leprechauns and pots of gold and green beer and that sort of thing. But St. Patrick, the man, had an incredible devotion to God. Like the monks, the Desert Fathers, who were trying self-denial in order to serve God better. St. Patrick, he denied himself, but he didn't run to the desert. He said, God, where do you want me to serve? And he found Ireland. He sensed God calling him there. And over the course of the time that he was there, much of Ireland converted from pagan cult religions to Christianity. St. Patrick's Prayer, the one we're going to listen to on the MP3 that we're going to play, is a prayer about Christ being everywhere in our lives. And it's poetic. You may not get all the language right off the hop, but you might. And it's about Spirit living. When I was coming up with this sermon and I said, you know, self-centeredness dies when you live by the Spirit. What's living by the Spirit? And this song just came to me. And I said, you know, I want to share this with you guys because I think this is what Spirit living is about. So the last thing I want to say, remember, it's hard to do. We do have to make the choice to live by the Spirit. We naturally live by the flesh. But slowly over time, like an onion, God will peel back the layers. He will first show you something that seems so profound to you, and then a year later, he'll peel that one back, and he'll be like, oh, I got to deny the flesh even more and live for you. So it's part of God's redeeming process in our life. So, Spencer, if you want to cue the song now, please. Please listen and pray as we listen to it.